I had no idea why I would be going into business. You know, I wanted to be an astronaut when I was a kid, and I never, I didn't apply to any other university except the Air Force Academy. I had no backup plan if they hadn't accepted none. Right? I'm serious. So
you put all your eggs in the astronaut basket.
That was it, pal. That was it. You know, and you know, there you go.
Hello and welcome to the podcast, 10 Lessons It Took Me 50 Years to Learn. We talk with sages and gurus, leaders and luminaries, experts from all over the world to find out what they've learned in life that can help you in yours. My name is Duff Watkins and I'm your host. Our guest today is Don Peppers. Don is one of those genuine thought leaders. I'm not making that up. I can prove it. Don has been ranked in the top 50 business brains by the London Times. He's on the top 50 business intellectuals. He's ranked among the 50 most influential thinkers in marketing and business. He's in the Hall of Fame for the Data and Marketing Association. He's authored 10 business books and 3 graduate school textbooks on customer-centric competition. Best of all, he's with us here today. Hi, Don. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Duff. Glad to see you again. Glad to be here.
I have to ask you this. Now, you went to the United States Air Force Academy. You graduated with a degree in astronautical engineering. You got your master's from Princeton in public affairs. How the hell did you end up in the Marketing Hall of Fame?
Well, I finally found something I really like to do. That's really the story. I joke, but I've never, ever held a job for which I actually was educated.
Yeah. Well, taxpayers may have something to say about that, but just still, nonetheless, you know, marketing's a game.
I know. It was a great education. I really wanted to be an astronaut, but my eyes went bad in my senior year, and so I couldn't go to flight training. And I was an air intelligence officer after Princeton. Princeton was on a fellowship, and you know, I did really well in the Air Force, but then I think I kind of burned my bridges behind me when I left. If you ask me what I most regret in life, is that's one of the things. I don't think I treated them very kindly when I left. You know what I mean?
Well, that's a lesson, though. Where you start out in life and where you end up can be vastly different. And yes. And the journey is a lot of fun, too. Okay, well, let me ask you, speaking of business, what do you recall your very first business lesson?
I think my biggest and this most central business lesson I've ever really learned is to bank favors generously. I call it putting favors in the favor bank. I would much rather have someone be in my debt than me be in their debt. And it doesn't bother me at all to be generous with my time, to do things for no immediate payoff. I don't get the calculator out to determine whether this is worth it for me or not. I look at it as it's almost a moral quest for me to give more than I get. In a sense, in perfect awareness that I'm going to get a lot. It's great. I'm going to be fine. Thank you.
We'll speak more about that because that's on the list of lessons. But speaking of the list of lessons, let us begin. Lesson number one, life is not a contest. No one takes first place.
Right. I grew up thinking that I could take first place. I graduated first in my high school. I was first in my class at the Air Force Academy. I was always first. I always wanted to be the top dog. But the lesson I've learned is that it's not a contest. Life isn't a contest. Life is a blessing. And no one really knows why we have conscious thought and emotions and so forth. But gosh, what a terrific thing it is. So that's my first lesson. Life isn't a contest.
That reminded me, there was a psychologist whom I admire. He put it this way. He said, it's not like he who dies with the tightest ass wins. You know, that made me think of a lot of business
right.
people.
Because
yeah. It sure
he
seems.
Who dies with the most stock doesn't win. Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, it does take a bit of time sometimes to learn that lesson. So life is not a contest. No one takes first place. All right. Lesson number two, forgiveness is relaxing.
Yes, I learned this lesson when I was in my 40s. I got a book called Why Forgive. I have the book here. I could put my fingers on it right now. We still have a couple copies. My wife and I both read the book, and we thought it was such a terrific book about the benefits of forgiveness on the forgiver, not the forgiven, on the forgiver. And we actually donated, we bought 10 copies and donated them to the church when we left town. So you give it to everybody. And basically, when you really let go with some wound or damage or something you think somebody did wrong or some harm, it tends to put your mind at rest. You feel good about it. If you can feel good about it, you should feel good about it. It basically is it's a tonic for the soul. For the soul of the forgiver. And I'm not religious, but I do believe that being able to step back from a situation and actually forgive a party who's wounded you in some way and put it behind you is a really great way to put salve on the wound.
That reminds me, in my work in executive development, I use a lot of psychometric assessment. Mm-hmm. There's a scale that I use, and it actually is a measure of do people who keep score when they should be cooperating. And if you've worked with those kinds of people, you know what it's like. You know, everything is tabulated and real and imaginary slights and insults go into the spreadsheet and sometimes accrue with interest and sometimes it compounds. Oh, yeah, man, right. You know, that's hard. Yeah, I got to work with those people. But your key point, as I take it, is you forgive because it's good for us, the forgiver.
For you. Yeah, it's good for the forgiver. It really is good for the forgiver. And that makes it a lot easier to undertake, actually.
And one of your points about this was about being kind. And wait a minute, you seem to be going over the top here, Don. You're saying be kind to even people I dislike? I mean, come on.
Yeah, and there's nothing better than being kind to an enemy. It gives you a really good feeling. I hate to tell it this way, but it almost makes you feel superior. And the truth is, maybe you are superior. Now, I have a great deal of difficulty carrying this off. When I get harmed or wounded, my first instinct is to gnash out. I grit my teeth and I hate them. But if you can step back and get away from that feeling, it's much more emotionally mature and satisfying over the long term for you.
Well, and you're pointing out a psychological truism because one, there is a benefit to you. Two, it does take exertion on your part. In fact, you're reminding me of something that Dalai Lama said. He said, you know, you need all those dickheads and those difficult people in your life. And you say, why? Why do I need more dickheads in my life? He said, because so you can practice your compassion, because you're not very good at it.
Yes.
You need all the practice you can get.
Right.
And they give us an opportunity to practice. And besides, we were discussing off air that it's an age-old saying, be kind, for everyone is carrying a heavy load, often misattributed to Plato, actually written by clergyman John Watson. But the point is, you have no idea what the other person is going through. You just have no idea.
No, you don't. And I think that it is good practice when you forgive and be kind to your enemies. It's really good practice for trying to see things through their eyes. Always ask yourself, if I were to do that to someone, what would I be thinking? What would be going through my head? And if that would be going through my head, I must really be unhappy. And this is a miserable life to live like that, or he must be just mistaken.
All right. Lesson number three, learn to live with yourself first.
Yes. I learned that lesson in my first marriage. I went to the academy. I went to Princeton. And toward the end of Princeton, I realized that I was going to have to go out and live by myself now. I didn't have mom to protect me or dad. I didn't have a roommate. I wouldn't have a roommate. And I had a girlfriend I really loved. I went over to visit her. She was an exchange student in Vienna for a little while. And I wanted to marry her, to have her come with me. And to, you know, I had to go off on the Air Force now. So, but I was going to be alone. I was going to be living by myself for the first time ever. And I was petrified of it. So what did I do? She said no. She had her own career. She said we could do it later, but not yet. She's not ready yet. And eventually, she became a TV personality in Miami on the news. She had a real successful life. But I was so petrified, I think, of being by myself that I met a girl who was really very vulnerable and I towered over her intellectually and I just felt like. But I asked her to marry me and she did. And we had two kids and then I got divorced like 10 years later. And I'm with a psychiatrist and I'm talking about this issue after, a counselor after our divorce. And she said, you know, you married her because you were petrified of being alone. You have to figure out how to live by yourself and be comfortable in your own skin with yourself first. And that was a big lesson for me. It took me a while and it was not easy. Not easy.
Yeah, it isn't. That resonates with my previous career as a psychotherapist. To me, it all starts with self-acceptance. And that sure sounds easy and kind of glib, but as you just illustrated, it isn't necessarily. And because you're facing yourself, you're telling yourself the truth, you're realizing you are clamoring over your defenses to face you. I don't know about you, but in my experience, you find out, well, it's not such a big deal after all. You know, you what you discover, you're just as human as everybody else. And for some reason, that comes as a shock or revelation to us. But
yeah, because you thought you were immortal, a human, and you thought you were Superman, and you find out you're not. More than that, for me, it had to do with just being comfortable that I was just like everybody else. I had my own faults and my own difficulties and my own problems. I had to face up to that. So, and I had to get comfortable with it.
How has that contributed to your career in business? In other words, how did you take that and implement it into your business life, your working life?
I'm not sure I ever really did per se. I have sometimes thought back on a decision I might have made, whether to, for instance, go out on my own, as I've done several times. And I think that was partly because I had learned to live with myself, and I could do things. I could do things alone if I wanted to, and I could live or not on my decisions, on my own actions. So maybe that's been helpful. I think it has been helpful.
Well, I guess the other part of that is learn to live with yourself first. And then once you master that,
then you can find someone who really loves you. Yes, right. Which I did, thankfully. I married a lovely woman, a woman named Pamela, I'm still married to. And she was a TV producer at the ad agency I eventually worked for. She's smart and funny and beautiful, and we have a lot of fun. Every day we thank our lucky stars that we met each other. I'm her lucky dog. I'm the lucky dog who met her. So,
you know, I mean, it's funny because you don't have to be perfectly intact in order to be a presentable, marketable commodity in the world of relationships. You know, you just
that's very commercially put, Duff.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, you know, people spend a lot of time on self-improvement. Nothing wrong with that, except, you know, when they make it a religion, and I've been guilty of that. You know, you just need to have a bit of insight and self-acceptance as to who you are and which warts and all. And then you'd be surprised how other people can accept you, however imperfectly you may be.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's not on the list of lessons, but I did learn to believe in love at first sight, because I got divorced from my first wife, and I was living in New York City, and I'd moved in with another guy who was also divorced, and we had been old friends in at one of our former jobs, and I went off to work in an ad agency, and I'm representing an airline. I was the North American advertising executive in charge of the British Airways account when Saatchi won the account, and Saatchi bought Compton Advertising in order to have a global network, and I was the North American guy. And my secretary called and said a producer wanted to see the new British Airways commercial. So I said, well, I'll show it to him myself. And she said, well, it's a girl, it's a woman, Pamela Devaney. So, okay, well, you know, give me the office. I'll just go down and show her the commercial. I went home that evening. I was gobsmacked. I took one look at her and I thought, oh my God. And I went home and I talked to Steve. I remember this perfectly well. That evening, I said, Steve, you'll never guess this. I think I met the woman I'm going to marry next. I think I met her. He said, really? Really? How'd you? I just happened in the agency. I don't even know if she's available, you know, but she's beautiful and wonderful and lovely. And Steve said, oh, I'm so happy for you. What's your name? Pam, I think. It was literally like that. And I never looked back. And eventually she didn't. It took me almost a year to get her to even go out with me. So there you go.
Well, I've heard stories like that before, and I've had a few of them myself. My wife made me ask her to marry her 4 times because I didn't get it right the first 3 times. You know, I need to keep practicing. You know, got to get the tone right. And
I had to ask Pam 3 times.
Yeah.
The third time for us was a charm.
Yeah, well, I got it right eventually, but
good. That's great.
Yeah, yeah. So, well, I mean, so I guess there's a lesson in there. You know, it doesn't always come easy. I mean, the easy bits getting smitten, as you were, and that's a fantastically wonderful feeling. And then comes the part of the effort, the discipline, the exertion of asking three or four times and making sure that you get it right. Okay, lesson number four. A job delivers a paycheck. A career delivers a purpose.
I'm in a career right now. I went from the Air Force. I went to an oil company. I was an economist for an oil company. I kind of liked it. It was sort of entrepreneurial. I really liked that part of it. They made me the director of accounting. I'd never had an accounting course, but I was in charge of the accounting and assistant treasurer in the subsidiary. And then I went to an airline and I became the director of pricing in the airline, which was sort of like accounting. It was very anal because it was regulated. Pricing was still regulated in the late 70s. And I was attracted to the marketing side and I found marketing. And our marketing found me, and I've been in love with marketing ever since because I'm a marketer. That was really what I was born to do, to be a marketer. Now I feel like I'm on a career. Martha Rogers and I came up with this book. The idea for the book took us 3 years to hatch. We published the book in 1993, The One-to-One Future, all about how companies are going to have to compete when you can interact with individual customers, one customer at a time, and you have a database and so forth. This was way before the internet, or not before the internet, but it was before the World Wide Web was established. And we sort of visualized this world of marketing. And now, you know, like all over the world, written, you know, 10 or 11 more books, depending on how you count them. And we've got a million copies in 18 languages. These are all my foreign language books. And these are the books we wrote in the US editions. When I think of my mission today, my mission is to make the world safer for customers. That's my mission. I'm constantly trying to see how can businesses treat customers better and profit in the experience of doing that. Does that make sense?
Yes, yes. I've had the pleasure of seeing you speak a couple of times in Sydney. And I've read two of your books. I think One-to-One Marketing is the first one I've read. And so you really are a world expert on customer experience. And you've got some great stories to tell. And the ones I always remember are when a company treats cavalierly or callously a customer, not knowing how much influence the customer has upon their business. And the one I always remember, Don, is some guy in a bank somewhere up in New England, and they're just treating him a little abruptly. And it turns out he was like, I don't know, the head of some big international firm. And so he closed their account with that bank or something like that.
Right. And there are all sorts of stories like that. And I have one right now. I tell about a dentist in Sydney who did the same thing. He had 12 or 13 dental practices around Sydney and had millions of dollars in the bank for these practices. And he happened to overdraw his personal account once and they bounced his check and he was so embarrassed that he transferred to a different bank. That's a classic kind of story where a company gets so big and so bureaucratic that one arm doesn't talk to the other one. They don't know who the customer is through all the services. A consultant once said that he had been a customer for this big bank. I don't remember the name of the bank that he worked, but it was like Citibank or Chase or one of the big U.S. banks. And he said he had a checking and savings account there. And that's how he started. Then he took a credit card and the credit card people treated him like he didn't have anything with the bank. They didn't know him. And then he took a home mortgage and they treated him just like they didn't know him. He said, the more I buy from them, the worse they treat me.
Well, that's true. Yeah, it's true. I mean, I've had that experience as well. And with the advent of social media, though, one of the things you pointed out in your anecdotes and your stories is that the customer is not powerless. They're not impotent. No. They're not necessarily idle.
No. And Mr. Untrustworthy Business, your customers are coming for you soon.
It's amazing. Anytime I have a complaint, and as I do from time to time with banks or utilities, as soon as I go online to Twitter and start bitching, moaning, and complaining, it's amazing how fast they get back to me. And the thing is, you know, you just wonder, why do I have to do that? Why do I have to be a squeaky wheel and start complaining, which is not really my preferred nature? in order to get a commercial response when I am the customer?
Well, the business ought to be proactively looking out for those kinds of complaints and issues. And I get it. Business is complicated. It's not easy. You need systems and devices and so forth. It's better if your whole business is based on how can we treat customers the way we'd like to be treated if we were the customer. But most businesses don't do that. They think about how can we give customers these benefits at the least cost? And in the short term, it maybe is the least cost, but in the long term, is it? Probably not. You know, in the long term, you're giving away customer equity. You're giving away customer goodwill. That's never profitable in the long term.
And just to go back to one of the central points, the career that you have found you, or you found it, and it wasn't right out of the box. It wasn't right after graduation. It was you had life experience in there, and it sounds like you did a lot of job sampling, which is a sort of a current phrase for it. You know, you're experiencing this, and you probably, I often say to people, you'll experience what you dislike, what you don't like, what you don't want a lot before you sort of tumble onto something that you do really enjoy. And then
it's like experimenting with life. You experiment, you should get as many experiences as you can to try to sort of see what you like, search wide. I had no idea why I would be going into business. You know, I wanted to be an astronaut when I was a kid. And I never, I didn't apply to any other university except the Air Force Academy. I had no backup plan if they hadn't accepted none, right? I'm serious. So
you put all your eggs in the astronaut basket?
That was it, pal. That was it. You know, there you go.
Yeah, that's like me putting all my eggs in the pro basketball basket. Well, you know, that's
exactly.
There's going to be a lot of empty shells in that basket, I can tell you. Jeez.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, I guess the point I want listeners to know, younger people, is that, you know, there is a lot of sampling. There's a lot of trial and error. There's a lot of experiencing.
Yeah.
And I like the way you put it. You said, you know, marketing found you. You found marketing. It's kind of hard to tell sometimes, but you know it. You know, it just kind of clicked.
Well, what's interesting about marketing, I remember having a conversation with somebody about the difference between marketing and, let's say, accounting. And I've held both jobs, both kinds of jobs. The thing about accounting is you can't really be a good accountant if you don't know the rules and if you're not familiar with the latest tax regulations and there's a tremendous amount of discipline in the knowledge base that goes into accounting. I was on an elevator with some colleagues when one of my advertising jobs, Lintas Worldwide, used to be part of Interpublic now. Mm-hmm. And somebody said, well, that guy, he didn't take any marketing courses. I said, well, you know, is talking about somebody. I said, well, neither did I. But the truth is you either get marketing or you don't, in my view. If you don't get marketing, you can take 4 years worth of courses and you're still not going to get it. But if you do get it, in about 2 weeks, you know everything you really need to know, you know, really to make reasonable decisions. In marketing. Marketing is a process of trying to find the mutually value-creating positions behind the buyer and the seller, the two parties, how to make it mutually beneficial. And it's a business of making the right deal or thinking about the incentives the right way, you know, and realizing that everybody wants something. Okay. And if you know what this person wants, then maybe there's value to be had by providing it for them. You know, that it's almost, I don't know. It's to me, it just seems so simple.
Say that again, the mutually.
Just two parties each have their own interests. And how can you strike a deal or an arrangement of some kind, some sort of interaction or exchange, which creates value for both of them, how it satisfies both of them. That's all marketing is looking for areas of common interest. The common interest is not there. I could be interested in something very different than you're interested in, but marketing is the process of finding where the exchange of value could take place and under what terms and how it would be beneficial to both. So both parties want to do it. The company wants to sell it and the customer wants to buy it, you know, and marketing is that simple. But it applies everywhere. It applies in politics too. It applies everywhere.
Yeah, the exchange of value. That's the phrase I'm locking on. Okay, well, let's return to the emotional finance. Lesson number five. Bank favors generously and regularly, I think you're saying. Tell me more about that.
Today, I'm often asked for favors and I can't return them all. I can't do everything. this podcast is an example. You know, I think people could benefit, and you're definitely going to benefit. And so I'm happy to do it because you're an old friend and a good colleague. And you know what? What goes around comes around sooner or later. And maybe so I think putting favors in the favor bank is just my expression for always trying to make sure that the balance sheet of your life and your business is in your favor, that there are more obligations out there to you than you have obligations to others. And you'll never collect on all of them, but you don't need to, just a few. They're investments. So favors in the favor bank are like stock options, okay? You don't know if they'll ever pay off, but maybe they do. And sometimes they do in a big way.
I don't know, but it just seems better and more natural. It feels better for me to be generous with time and requests and things like that. Yeah. And I know you are a generous guy, and I've seen it in Sydney on your speaking occasions, and right now it's a podcast, and so that's very much appreciated. And it does seem to benefit us as individuals and others who will hear this podcast.
Yeah, I think so. I hope so. And the whole idea is, I didn't step back and say, "Geez, this is an hour of time. What should we charge for this? What should we do this?" You know, you could be so anal about your. I'm a time and materials business, right? Mm-hmm. I charge for my time, and you know, but you have to give stuff away also, and we'll do something later. You know, who knows what'll happen? Or maybe somebody will listen to the podcast and call me up and say, "Hey, Don, I want to give you $1 million.
All right. Lesson number 6, you learn the most when you know the least. So be curious.
Yeah, I've developed a habit of reading. I read a lot of nonfiction books. I read books on the human brain. I read books on behavioral economics. I read books about the, working on a book right now about the adaptive economy by an economist named Lo. I'd never read anything of his before. And I read a couple of books on racism recently. Caste was a really, really good book about the caste systems that have existed in the world. And the blacks in the United States are lower caste people in the same way that lower caste people in India have been lower caste, in the same way that Jews were lower caste in Nazi Germany. And it's a really interesting book. There's another book called Me and White Supremacy. And the thing is, all these books answer questions for me. I think of it as satisfying my curiosity. In fact, I've heard the expression that curiosity is the highest moral attribute of a human being. Being curious about how the world works, how other people feel, how other things happen, is a moral obligation almost. Learning the most from the question you least know the answer to is a principle from a book I read about information entropy. Entropy in information is randomness. If I say to you, what's the next letter? If I give you these letters, B, U, C, K, E, what's the next letter?
T would be the most obvious reply.
Right. But if I give you the letters B, C, K, Z, what's the next letter? Nobody knows. You're not supposed to know. So entropy is randomness in the universe. But entropy is good in information. The less you have to put things in context, the faster the information transfers. An entropic question is a question that you can't predict the answer to already. Okay. And that was the lesson in this book. And so I really took that to heart. And when you're interviewing someone to try to find out whether they think this product is the right thing or not, or whether this is the right way to solve this problem, which marketers do all the time. It's research. Asking the question that you least know the answer to is the way to learn about the customer's real feelings the fastest. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I meant. And I think it's a good enough lesson. It serves people well in life and in business.
But it does start with being curious, and lack of curiosity is kind of an intellectual dormancy or deadness, or it can be a spiritual, emotional deadness.
It can be. I believe that constantly learning, and I'm a sucker for interesting facts. I call them factoids, interesting facts, and I collect them. And it's great for storytelling, which is my primary occupation. I'm a public speaker, right? but I always find the satisfaction of curiosity to be one of the best satisfactions there is.
Finding out stuff, just simply learning stuff you don't know. It can be very stimulating. Okay, lesson number 7. Think large. Ask yourself, will the world be better off if I do this?
Yeah, what I mean by that is I think you need to ask yourself at all points in your career whether if what you're doing is something that the world would actually value. The world is actually getting better because of this. I think that the world is getting better gradually for customers, and I think that I've hastened it along. And that's given me a great deal of emotional satisfaction, a great deal. You can almost look at it in terms of I am propelling the accelerated expectations of customers. Customers expect more from companies today than they did 10 years ago or 20 years ago or 30 years ago. And every day when a new competitor does something even better for customers, then other competitors have to imitate it or they will underperform to customer expectations. And if you look at the surveys of customer satisfaction over the years, the American Customer Satisfaction ACSI Index. It's a big score that's been in business for like 20, 25, maybe 30 years now, I don't know. But from the very beginning, the general level of customer satisfaction in America is hovering between, 60 and 63%. It's never changed. This customer service has gotten better and better and better. We have way better customer service today than we had when the ACSI first went into business. So why isn't satisfaction going? Because it's relative to expectations. The fact that customers' expectations are going up means that service is getting better and better and better and better. And I think that's making the world a nicer place.
Let me ask you this. I might have asked you this 5 years ago on a different podcast. Are customer expectations becoming unrealistic?
Never say never, but I don't think in general they're becoming unrealistic. I think in general, when you look at customer expectations that are not being satisfied, what you're looking at is a business opportunity, either for you to do it or for your competitor to do it. And so an unrealized expectation is an opportunity to realize it. It's a business opportunity. If you can figure out that exchange of value in some way. That's why it's a marketing task. What's the exchange of value? So I could satisfy this customer. This customer wants me to, they don't want to have to apply for a refund. Well, is there a way you could find out if they're due a refund before they apply? Of course, you could do that. So why don't you proactively give them the refund or tell them it's available and just touch here? All these expectations that customers have. Now, once you start doing that, as Amazon does, as JetBlue does, as many other companies are doing, everyone is going to have to do it pretty soon. It's like when you go into the grocery store today and the cashier gives you change for your cash. Do you count the change to make sure you aren't being cheated?
No.
Of course not. Yeah. Of course, nobody does that because nobody gets cheated anymore. People used to have to count their change. Because cheating was it used to be that if you weren't my relative or if I didn't know you personally, I'd really try to swindle you. So it's the world has become, the moral arc points upward, okay? Slow but sure. And that's what gives me great solace in my older age. I really feel like the world is getting better and I helped play a role in it. I feel very happy about that.
Well, on behalf of customers all over the world, we thank you for that because we need it. But you're right. I've heard that moral arc trending upwards, blah, 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 Martin Luther King, Obama, yada, yada, yada. But then I look around and then I have my doubts until I read Steven Pinker's book, The Better Angels of Our Nature. Have you come across that one?
Yes.
It is absolutely riveting. And he
only 1,000 pages.
And he documents it so, so, so well, so convincingly that
Pinker is a terrific writer. I've read almost all his books. I think. I think I might have read all of his books, but I don't know how he has time to write these books. And he's a really iconoclastic thinker.
He is. I mean, he's got a demanding job. He's a full time professor at Harvard, but he seems to crank out these books, and they're all, every one is just a thought provoking. Seminal work. So, but as I say, he pretty much convinced and persuades anyone who cares to read the book that the world is getting better, and he's got the proof. So it is real.
And I agree with him 100%. I could have written that book myself. I guess I should have.
It's not too late. Do the marketing version.
Yeah. Right.
All right. Speaking of cheating, lesson number 8: temper your temptations, resist the urge to cheat or to game the system. You seem to be implying that we're going to get opportunities to cheat or game the system.
Yes, I think life is full of those opportunities, and I have done it once or twice, and I can't think of a time that I've done it that I haven't ended up regretting having done it, either because I got caught once or twice, but more than that, even if I didn't get caught, I felt like I had betrayed myself. And the thing is, the more trusting the world is, the more trusting people are, the more opportunities it presents for cheating. Because to cheat somebody, you have to con them into thinking that you're honest, right? And if everybody's honest, and I believe everyone's honest, then I'm going to be easy to cheat, easy to steal from, easy to, you know, connive. And I think game playing with the rules, taking advantage of the rules, even if you're not legally cheating, if you're just conniving, I don't know, that I think it just leaves me with a sour feeling. I can't really describe it. I'll give you a really good example. I'll give you a good example. It just happened recently. I have a friend who made a lot of money, had a big short-term gain that he wanted to take. And I have a very large short-term loss carry forward on my tax return. And I thought, well, is there a way that I could use my cash tax loss carry forward to help him pay for his gain? And there's a way, you know, and I talked to the accountant and basically I give him a gift of this and he gives me a gift of that, but it's not really a gift, is it? You know, but technically, you know, only legally it might be a gift, but then I ask, you know, what would I say to my own son if he asked, why did you do this? And how would I explain that? And so I declined. So in the end, we didn't do anything. We didn't do a deal because it could be done legally. We can get an accountant to bless it, but it didn't feel right. And I wouldn't be able to tell the truth to the auditor if the tax auditing came around. I'd have to say, oh, it was just a gift. I just decided to give this person something, you know, and it wasn't. And I guess, so that's an example of how a lot of people have no problem playing that game. If they can make a buck here, a buck there. But I think playing the game like that, you can get rich by robbing a bank too.
Well, what you're describing is the emotional, psychological cost of conniving and yes, which I've experienced myself as well. I'll give you a personal example. Years ago, 20 years ago, I was caught riding the train in Sydney with an expired pass. The rail cop, you know, and now they didn't arrest you or do anything. They just said, would you mind, you know, paying this, you know, because it's expired and you're riding the rail for it. And 20 years later, I still feel ashamed about that. You know, yes. I went home and I said, I had a talk with myself. I said, self, what the hell are you doing? You got the money. You got the money. Yeah. I mean, what kind of character? That has not happened again, Don, let me tell you. But it's like, man, the way people undermine themselves, the way we undermine ourselves, and that's what it is.
And the thing is, Duff, 20 years ago, I would have done that deal in a flash because I was still cutting deals like that. I was still conniving. I was still thinking about, but by the time I became reasonably successful, it dawned on me that it's a unproductive and counterproductive, really, idea, that conniving.
Well, all you gain is the money, you know, that's all. And you lose other elsewhere. So because there is a cost to it.
You lose your self-respect.
Oh, that was what I experienced. So temper your temptations. Those opportunities to cheat or game the system are coming your way, friends. So
and watch out for them.
All right, lesson number 9. Do the existential math. Count your blessings. See, acknowledge, dwell on those good things.
Yeah, my wife and I, before we go to bed each night, we do an exercise. We name one or two or three things that really went well today. And we count that. We dwell on it. We think about it. Oh, it was really great talking to our daughter in London today. That was a lot of fun. Or so-and-so got a new job and she was really excited, you know, or, you know, just things like that. We just think about all the good stuff that happened. And what we found is that it cheers us up in our lives. We are thinking about things that are, it's basic positivity 101 is what it is, you know, positive thinking 101. And when I think about it, I am one of the most fortunate human beings alive today. You know, I really am. I can't think of anybody who was born more fortunate than I was. And my parents weren't millionaires, but they were well off in a small town. My dad was an engineer, really smart. My mom doted on me. I was blessed with an IQ, good IQ, and I was lucky in a lot of ways. And I don't want to forget, I wasn't born black. I wasn't born female. I didn't have any undeserved disadvantages at all. And I've been so lucky. I have been so fortunate. So for me to think of my accomplishments in life as my accomplishments, it's not really fair. I was very lucky to have the ability to do what I've done. And I need to constantly keep that in mind. I was dealt a really good hand. And I am so lucky to have been dealt that hand. I just want to give back once in a while. That's really, really what I'm saying here.
Do you remember when you realized how lucky you were?
When I was growing up, I thought it was all me. I'm Superman. I can do everything, you know, and really until I got married again to Pam and we started having kids, it really was. But I will tell you this also. I had a period in the beginning of the pandemic when everybody's by themselves. We're all locked in, you know, and I'm in my office all the time. And I got a little depressed about it. So I went online and took a course on Coursera on positive thinking. And that's where Pam and I got our three blessings idea. And that started me thinking very seriously about how fortunate I am. And then with the Black Lives Matter movement and the Me Too movement, I was always nominally non-racist and a non-misogynist. And yet I wasn't actively anti-racist or anti-bigamist. Because I wasn't affected by it. Affect my life, right? And that's made me more and more aware of just how fortunate how much good fortune has played in my life and not just my own sterling and personal ability.
I think the realization that when it comes to you, that all the good fortune that you enjoy is not strictly due to you. That's the mark, an emotional milestone for some people.
Well, it was for me.
It's an important one. So, yeah. So count your blessings, list them, write them, update them.
Yeah. About them. Dwell on them a little bit. That's all. Just dwell on them a little bit.
And remain cognizant of the unfair, unselected advantages that you just happen to inherit. That's always good advice.
Yes. And be charitable to others. Yeah.
All right. Lesson number 10. I think I know where you're going with this, Don. Keep a few $10 bills on you at all times. I know where you're going, Don, because you're right. Because you might see some cool stuff you want to buy and you want to have the money to buy it, right? That's what you mean, huh?
No, I keep some cash on me. I've got a little stack of $10 bills in the car so that I can sometimes give a $10 out to an unfortunate person. You know, in the United States, maybe this doesn't happen much in Brazil, but in the United States, when you're driving on the highway and on the road, when we drive through San Francisco, we stop at a stoplight. Every once in a while, there'll be a homeless person there collecting, you know, and I always want to have a $10 bill available. Because it gives me such great pleasure personally. It just makes me feel good to be able to brighten somebody's life even a little bit. And so that's why I said that. It's one of my 10 life lessons. Keep a supply of bills on you that you can give away. It's not gonna put any less food on my table. It's not going to give us any sleepless nights to give $10 to somebody. It'll give me pleasure. It makes me feel good. It's the happiness that I personally get from giving something to someone else. And some people say, oh, well, you know that they're just cheating you. Nah, I don't know that. And you know what? If they are, so what?
So what? Yeah.
Still makes me feel good.
The guy that opened my eyes to this was the Dalai Lama when he said something like, when you see a homeless person or somebody on the street and they're sitting there begging for alms, he said, give them money. You know, it means nothing to you. It means something to them.
And it means a lot more to them than it means to you.
I had to think for a second. I said, wait a minute. He says, give them money. Don't think about it. Just, you know, give them loose change. Yeah. I got to say, Don, I'm embarrassed to say, but I mean, I'd never really thought about it that way. Let me ask you one final question. We've been talking about the things that you've learned in life. What about something you've unlearned lately? And by that, I mean something you absolutely positively knew to be true then, but now realize is not the case.
I think I'm in the process of unlearning what I've believed for most of my professional career was that the free market was always better and more efficient than government or regulatory spending. I still believe that when you have a free competitive market, there are forces involved that sort of make things much more efficient and satisfy more people. But I don't think there are very many free competitive markets. Okay. Even in the United States, the market's not free. It's not competitive. It's monopolized by a few big tech companies in the tech space. It is monopolized by a few very large banks. The businesses are very crowded. What government regulations are there have largely been implemented at the behest of the regulated. And so I'm coming around to the belief that more social, i.e. government action, is probably called for in our economic system than I used to think. I'm not a socialist, and I still believe in the benefits of investment and capitalism and competition among businesses. But I no longer believe that the free market system is actually as free as I used to think it was. Some regulation should be. And for me, this is a very big change of heart.
Yeah, it would be. Yeah, it would be.
Yeah, because I'm a Milton Friedman type economic student. And the thing is, if we were truly a competitive free market system, then I still believe that's probably more efficient than almost anything else, any other system, and better for everybody in general. But we're not. We're highly concentrated in certain sectors. We're highly favored by regulations in other sectors. Anyway, so that's, you asked, that's what I believe.
The Korean British economist Ha Jun Chang put me straight on that. And yeah. If you want to read some economics, there is a guy for you. I've been trying desperately to get him on the podcast.
Chiang, or
how I'll email you Ha Jun Chang. I think I'll have to email because I might be. He teaches at Cambridge. But between him and Alexander Hamilton, of all people, and I've been a fan of Hamilton well before the musical, let me just point that out, and how he put the U.S. economy on the map and industrialized it and was heavily protectionist and was very clear-eyed about the role of government and the role of markets. So, but the point is, the fact that you're willing, able to change your perspective and to learn something new rather than be simply wedded to a past conception. I mean, I always tell
people, ideology.
Yeah, an ideology. And I always tell people the next free market you see will be the first free market you'll see because they don't exist. You know, you'll be lucky if you can get a fair market. Anyway, that aside. So is there anything else you'd like to leave our listeners and viewers with, Don?
No, just have fun in life. I think you can have more fun and feel better about yourself by being better to others. That's all.
And we'll finish on that note. You've been listening to the podcast, 10 Lessons That Took Me 50 Years to Learn. Our guest today has been Don Peppers, one of the world's foremost experts on customer-centric business, customer experience. This episode is produced by Robert Hossery and, as always, is sponsored by the Professional Development Forum, PDF. You can find them online, professionaldevelopmentforum.org. They provide social seminars, webinars, podcast parties, everything you need, anything you want. It's all online and it's all free. And remember, this is the podcast that makes the world wiser lesson by lesson. You can email us at podcast@10lessonslearned.com. That's podcast@10lessonslearned.com. Thanks for listening to us, and please join us in the next episode of 10 Lessons That Took Me 50 Years to Learn.